We're studying Hebrews, the epistle to the Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, to the Hebrews. There's a few resources that we have for people to help make the class go well. One of those things is a handbook, a study guide. I'm going to talk about this hopefully a little bit later. I'm fairly familiar with this because I taught this class 20 years ago, maybe, and we used this book. Now, it's been revised over time. Dave put this together. We spotted lots of grammatical errors and spelling errors over the years, and he continues to fix it and make it better and better and better. He sent this out electronically, and the idea is that you've got it electronically, and you can print it up at home. However, if you want a hard copy of this, please let me know. There were some up here, so some people have already grabbed hard copies, and that's great. We will make more hard copies if you want them. You should have it electronically. If you don't have it electronically, check your email. Let Dave and I know. We'll send you another copy if you want it. The other resource that we have is this little Hebrews journal. So how many people do not have one of these, or how many people need one of these? Okay. You may go ahead and break the seal. Anyone else here? Okay. Anyone else over there? Awesome. Yes, you can each have one. You don't have to share with a spouse. We've got plenty of these, and we can get more of these. The idea behind this, I'll talk about this in a little bit, but if you check it out, it's done in the ESV version of the text, so that's really helpful in a class if we're all, for the most part, using one version or working out of one version. By all means, if you're just not an ESV person, and you need another version of it, you want another version of it, you can do that. You can use your Bible, right? All of this is in the Bible. This is just one book of the Bible in a book form. But what's cool about it is it's kind of set up to have the text on one side, space on the other to journal, to write things down, to put questions, to put comments, to put notes, to do whatever you want with. So bring that with you. That's probably like the key piece to have when you come to class is your thoughts as you've prepared. I'll talk about it again a little bit later, but this is kind of designed to at home prepare maybe and do a few things. You can bring this. There's no rules about any of this stuff, but we're going to really try and work out of the text, and I think this is a great resource to have your notes and your information and keep us all on the same page, almost literally. So that's some of the background on that. What else? We have a really full class. I know not everybody's able to be here today, so yeah, the sooner you get here, the better the seat. The sooner you get here, the more likely you are to get a big, puffy, comfortable purple chair instead of a really hard, kind of rigid red chair. Jeff's going to get stuck with the hard, rigid red chair. That's the way it's going to be. Oh, no, there's a puffy purple one back there by his wife that he can stand.
Thanks.
All right, Jeff, we're recording all of this. And if there's anyone who needs to really be aware that what they're saying is going to be recorded, you're one of those people. All right, so what we're going to try and do this morning is just kind of do the introduction part of this. I doubt we'll get into any of the meat of it right away, but I want to just get an overview of Hebrews and kind of see where different people are at also in the room. So by way of doing that, we're going to start with this basic fundamental question, and we're going to record a few thoughts. I want you to think about what you know about Hebrews. How many people have studied this before, been in a class about Hebrews? Excellent. Okay, so you probably have some background on this. You probably remember a few things. Some of you were probably very diligent and already dove into the first chapter and have already started looking at some things and remembering a few things. So, when you think about Hebrews, what comes to mind? What do you already know about this book, this letter?
Author
Rich.
Unknown.
Author unknown. Yeah, that's always a really big controversy or an interesting thing to talk about, or tons of analysis have been done about that. Rich?
It's a lot of theology.
Okay. I'm going to call that theology-based, not that, I mean, just more so maybe than most books. It's got a lot of theological stuff, a lot of doctrinal stuff, a lot of... And that's really significant, I think, to the audience and who the writer's writing to, why he's writing about all of this. So there's a lot of theology and a lot of commentary about that theology. So he gives us some background on why he's telling us that stuff, but it also requires sometimes we go and do a little research behind the scenes. Awesome.
Maybe this is the same thing as what Rich just said, but there's a lot of Old Testament references.
Okay.
And given the audience, that makes sense.
Yeah, depending on how you can, that is connected to a lot of the theology based, but an important part of the book that we're going to see is it's trying to connect the Old Testament to the New Testament or to Christianity. So it's more than just, the theology is more than just the Old Testament, but the Old Testament becomes a huge part of this. And there are, depending on how you count, over 20 just quotes directly from the Old Testament where the writer goes, remember this was said, and don't forget, you already know this was said, and kind of quotes some pieces directly. Okay. Rich.
So there, in relation to that, there's a lot of compare and contrast to the Old and New Testament, and okay. It shows the New as supreme, and yeah, I'll get that.
Comparisons.
Supremacy of the New.
A lot of metaphor in this, and there's kind of a theme that emerges of the supremacy of Jesus. The supremacy of the Christ is a big part of this. Okay, what else? What else do you know about Hebrews? Dan.
The date of the book, it sounds like it was done before the destruction of the temple.
Okay.
So it's probably, it makes reference to the temple that it's been standing. So it's dated probably before the destruction of the temple. Probably 1600.
Yeah. Probably, we'll talk about that in a second, probably somewhere before 70. Okay. Rich, and then Jan.
The Faith Hall of Fame in chapter 11.
It's got a lot of verses that if you were to read it, you would go, oh, that's in Hebrews? Oh, yeah, that's in Hebrews. Oh, that's in Hebrews. And chapter 11 is one of those very famous chapters, chunks of the Bible, often referred to as the that Faith Hall of Fame. It's kind of almost bringing this whole thing to some really important crescendo moment by going through this short, brief history of the Jewish people and people that weren't Jewish, people that predate the whole Jewish system, and talking about faith, and talking about how they had faith, and talking about how they demonstrated faith. So that's in this. That's a big part of this. Good. Jan.
Well, obviously it seems like we all know this, but we haven't said it. That the audience, it's written to Jewish Christians.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get a minute here to start to look at that a little bit and dig into that. But that's a really important dynamic. A dynamic that we're probably all aware of existed in the first century, and a dynamic that's interesting to think about because there are some people who had to go through a really difficult, challenging shift in their life in terms of being raised Jewish and raising their family to be Jewish and understanding everything that was involved in that and doing that at a time when the nation of Israel was gone and now had been gone through at least four different other nations controlling them and possessing them, and now they're living under Roman rule. And then here comes this big shift that says, the whole idea of salvation is now different. The Messiah you've been waiting for has come. Jesus Christ has been crucified and resurrected from the dead, and now that's going to change a lot of things. And we know, just by reading Acts, amongst apostles, that was like conflicting, that was challenging, that was a hard thing to deal with. There was a lot of baggage involved in that. And we have probably a few decades down the road after some of that, some people dealing with that and dealing with persecution and now looking back at Judaism, and it's kind of a complex stew of a lot of cultural challenges and religious challenges that people had. And it's why this writer kind of steps in and goes, hey, I need to talk to you as Christians and people who I understand culturally are Jewish and now are really thinking about giving up Christianity and going back to Judaism. And he's, of course, reminding them, that's a huge problem. That's a huge problem. You've got to rethink that. Russ?
Well, I'm going along with the audience there. It restates over and over that Jesus was who he claimed to be, and that he was God.
Yeah, I like that. Jesus is who he claimed to be, and he claimed to be the Son of God, and that's a big deal, and you can't forget that. It is a big part of his message. Very good. What else about Hebrews stands out? Allison.
I got this just from page 6. Okay. FYI, not. I just got it this morning when I was reviewing the materials, but on page 6, it has these 5 things highlighted, and it all starts with the word warning.
Okay.
So there's these 5 warnings.
Yeah, there's some warnings in this. We'll talk in a little bit about just the literary style of it, and it's interesting to look at those kind of things, and it's got these moments in it where there's kind of a big red flag that's flashing at the people that are reading this as he's trying to connect what he's saying about the theology in the Old Testament and about Judaism and a warning to these people to think about this, to really think about this and consider what their actions are and how their actions need to change. Very good. What else?
The persecution that was going on against Christians at that time.
Yeah, as we get into the why would people like start to give up on Christianity? Why would people start to go back? Well, there's some context there in all of this complex Roman rule and Jewish resistance and Roman support casually for Judaism at times, a tolerance of it as long as it doesn't go too far, and maybe that's a little safer place, and some of the politics and deals that have been struck between the Jews and the Romans and how Christians are starting to throw all of that off. And there's just, if you're a Christian, especially a Christian who's Jewish, and especially if this is happening where I think it's happening, you kind of got pressure all the way around. You got pressure from everyone and everything, and you can start to feel that pressure coming in on you. And that pressure is what's leading to some of this reversal in thinking and some of this going back and some of this giving up on Christianity. And so he's trying to be sensitive to that. He's trying to understand that, but he's trying to warn them. You can't, that's not going to cut it. That's not going to cut it. You're going to have to stick with what you're trying to do here. What else? Anything else that stands out about Hebrews that you think about? What do you think about Hebrews? Rich.
There is an intellectualist appeal to it. It's not like, you know, 1 John that's kind of plain talk. I mean, the way it's written, the vocabulary, the structure of his sentences, I mean, it's...
You got to be intellectual to spell intellectualist.
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Say more. Keep going with what you're saying.
Saying that it, unlike some other books like, I don't know, Mark or 1 John, that are just very plain, very straightforward, this one's not.
Yeah.
The way it's written is complicated. The ideas are complicated. It's appealing to something in Judaism that was kind of intellectually snobbish, right? I mean, they were into their educational tradition, and this appeals to that.
Yeah, it's what makes it, I think, appealing to study. James is great to study because it's on that other end of the spectrum where it's just sort of like, boom, here it is. I mean, here's the information, and everybody can relate to that. And this, you have to read it, and you have to kind of read it again, and you have to kind of pause on it, especially if you're not an intellectual Hebrew steeped in some of this. I think they were, and their leaders were, and many of the people this was written to were, and they probably didn't have to read it 2 or 3 times. They knew exactly what was going on here. It'll require a little bit of intellectual work on our part, I think, from that standpoint, to dig into that.
The subject of sacrifice comes up, something I call bulls and goats, but you can word it how you want.
Aye.
It's not right. It's not right. Sacrifice comes up a lot, right? No? Honey? Am I, is that right? Okay. All right.
Well, we'll figure that out. Just don't wipe it on your clothes.
Those teachers who used to lean up against the chalkboard and then turn around and it was chalk everywhere. These Old Testament references, this theology based, okay, we start to get into what are some of these Old Testament themes, these metaphors that we talked about earlier, or these comparisons that are going to come up. Sacrifice is one of them, right? There's going to be this comparison between sacrifice in the old and sacrifice in the new. What are some of these other comparison points that are going to come up like that?
Jesus is the ultimate high priest.
Okay. And to Rich's point about this intellectualist approach, you got to dig into what the high priest was and did, what the sacrifice was all about a little bit. Jeff and then Andrew.
One of the ones, and maybe, I'm sorry about stealing your thunder.
It's already happened once.
How I roll? One of the ones we see right off the bat is Jesus versus angels.
Okay. Yeah, angels is a comparison point. Was your thunder stolen?
No, by Jack earlier, so it's all good. But also, he's better than Moses. He talks about all of these comparisons.
Yeah. Others? Yeah, other comparisons that come to mind?
Aaron?
He's a high priest.
Okay. He's a high priest. And in the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek becomes this figure in this thing. I remember as a kid hearing people talk about Melchizedek. I don't even know.
Kizzy.
I remember being fascinated by that because I wasn't familiar with that. And then you found out this, like, no, he's mentioned in the Bible. Oh, where's the book of Melchizedek? No, he's like briefly mentioned, and that's kind of all we have. And yet there's this big, significant comparison that he's a priest in the order of Melchizedek, which is different than the whole conversation about the high priest in the Jewish system, right? What else?
With all of that, and yet he's made like that.
Okay, his humanity is also talked about.
So, although he's God, he learned obedience. Remember God being through what he suffered.
Which sometimes kind of references back to this because he can relate to us and what we're going through and what we can't do, he was able to do, which makes him this really significant sacrifice. So these things start to all connect. They all start to connect in this.
He mediates a better covenant because it's based on better promises.
The covenant comparison is going to come up. Sabbath rest is going to come up as a comparison point. There's all these interesting comparison points, and it's why we study the Old Testament. It's why it's good for us to have that information. It's why we know that we wouldn't make sense of Hebrews in this really deep thinking, really important, really applicable, I think at times, applicable to our lives book if we didn't ever have any context for this Old Testament stuff. So, Scott.
The temple.
The temple is another one. Great. Okay. All right. So, good. We've got some people who know something about this book. We've got some background around this book. The author is not identified. That makes it unique. There's very few books, really, in the Bible where we're like, it doesn't really say who wrote that or who's writing this, or it's hard to figure out who that is. And what I'm going to say about that is nothing. I do a little commentary work, and of course commentators love that. You get more about who wrote this than you get about who didn't write it. And all of them, to be fair, kind of conclude, hey, could be this person, could be Paul, could be Priscilla, and it could be Luke, and it could be Luke working with Paul, and it could be all of these things, and that's really interesting, but it's clearly somebody who knows this stuff, knows this theology, knows the significance of this Old Testament, knows these people. We'll look at that in a second. But beyond that, it's really hard to kind of, and I don't know that it matters too much.
And maybe it's interesting that in this particular book, it's not identified. That might be the more interesting part of it than actually who it is. If this writer wanted to be identified, it seems like this writer would have been identified. Maybe that's interesting to think about along the ways. Why didn't the writer want to put his name on it?
It's not actually unique. There's lots of books in the Bible that we don't know who wrote it. It doesn't say who wrote it. But by the second or third century, they had a tradition about who wrote it. It's just they couldn't make up their minds about who wrote it.
Right.
Right? So it's not, the difference isn't, you know, because we don't know who wrote several of the, sure. I mean, especially the Old Testament, but so the fact that Christians use this book in the second century and the third century, right? That's what matters, and they already knew, they already had lost who wrote it, right? But so it's not actually that unique. It's that we can't know because they couldn't make up their minds.
Yeah, I think it's Clement of Rome before the end of the first century is writing about this book and quoting from this book and talking to people about this book. This book was really powerful. It was really powerful, really significant. And that's, you know, probably as important as the author concept. I think Dana brought this up, and I think it's, I remember, I've always heard when we're looking at epistles and things in the New Testament, people will say, well, it's probably written before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem because the book doesn't mention the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And I've always thought, well, so what? Maybe people just, like, that wasn't on their mind or that wasn't significant. However, this seems like this would be one of those books that would be incredibly significant in light of all these things that we wrote over there. And like Dana points out, if you turn over to Hebrews 9:11, I think there's one place in this. I'm having to learn to teach class with these. And this is very complicated. Because I have to put them on to read this and then take them off to read that. And so we're a little slow in that. Hebrews 9:11. Brian, can you read that?
Yes, my fat fingers can turn. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that had come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation.
Keep going.
He entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption.
Yeah, and look over at 13:10. Look over at 13:10. And there might be other references to this, but there seem to be passages that indicate the temple's still standing in some way, shape, or form. That it's still around. That as he's talking about this, let's say 13:10. That as he's talking about this, these things still exist. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat, as he's explaining this. There's a lot of present tense that seems to indicate, and would have been a golden opportunity for him to say, a big significant event has occurred where the temple is gone and that no longer exists. In fact, I think that would have been a huge point of this book if it was gone, for him to say, see, and there's the final reason why. That's the symbol of the fact that this is no longer significant or important as Jesus prophesied was going to happen. But that doesn't seem like that's happened because he doesn't mention any of that. And so this probably gets ahead of 70 AD or 70 CE. There's other significant events that would occur in this time that history records, like in 64, the great fire of Rome. And what's significant about the fire that occurs in Rome in 64 as a general rule? What's significant to Christianity? Yeah, Nero seems to kind of use that. History tells us that one perspective on this is Nero kind of used that, blames it on the Christians. It kind of takes what already was an existing kind of pressure and tension on Christians and kind of lights a fire towards persecution. And so there's going to be big persecution that comes in the wake of that. And when we talk about the persecution effect of this, it's quite probable that what we're looking at is somewhere that maybe predates that a little bit. And that some of what he's talking about here is, hey, you think it's bad right now, he's going to say in Hebrews. There's some really difficult times that are coming. There's some challenging things that are going to happen. And it's possible this is kind of getting ahead of that, and certainly ahead of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And so we could probably put this somewhere around 60 to 70 is when this is being written. And that's a challenging, difficult time, and that would fit the context of what's going on with Christians being persecuted and with some of the challenges that Jews have who are Christians. So the audience is really significant. Somebody mentioned this, and we can't lose this thread that these are Christians, but these are Christians with some deep Jewish roots and some deep Jewish connections. Let's look at Hebrews 6, 9, 10, and 11.
Another comment on that.
Yep. Go ahead, Jim.
So I think that Judaism is already starting to transition away from the use of sacrifice and the centrality of sacrifice for remission of sins. But there were a lot of Christians that, for whom the temple was very, very important. In fact, that's why James recommended to Paul when he came back, is go ahead and offer a sacrifice to help make him more palatable to the Christians there in Jerusalem. And one of the things that I think that Hebrews might, this is just a supposition, 100% supposition, might be accomplishing is, it's this book, if it's in circulation at the time of the destruction, it's going to have prepared those people for whom the Christians, for whom the temple is important, to recognize that God has allowed this temple to be destroyed because it had no more use for them.
Very good. Yeah, it's I think about this book, this letter, existing and being talked about in its theology as this is happening in AD 70. This had to be comforting on some level. This had to be a good reminder, as challenging as that is. This had to be a visual symbol of, yeah, all of that is being wiped out and is going away. And there's no value in salvation through that. Jesus Christ is going to be the key point for our salvation. That's a good way of looking at that. We can see these are Christians. We can see these are saints. We can see these are people in Hebrews 6, 9 through 11, that have been practicing Christianity. He says, though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things, things that belong to salvation. For God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name and serving the saints, as you still do. And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end. These are Christians. These are Christians in this backdrop of Jewish theology. Take a look at Hebrews 10, 32 and 33. Who would like to read that? Hebrews 10, 32 and 33. David.
But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated.
Okay, what does that tell us about these people? They're not just Christians, but what can we infer from what he's saying in this little piece?
They've been persecuted.
Yeah, they've been going through some difficult times. He says this is not the first time. Recall some previous challenges and some previous issues. And if this audience is Christian Jews that are living in Palestine, that are close to and or in Jerusalem, they've already gone through this whole Saul persecution and that whole effort right when the church was first starting. They've already had resistance from Jewish people as they converted to Christianity and had to, you know, that whole Jesus brought a sword amongst family members. That's a big part of what he's talking about. They've already endured a lot of hardships. And he's saying, hey, you've been down this road before. So it also tells us there's some distance, I think. This is not happening in the early years of the church. There's been some time. There's been perhaps a generation of Christians that have grown up as Christians whose parents were Jews who are now experiencing this. We can see that in places like Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13. Look at Hebrews 13, 7, and then Hebrews 13 and verse 19. I think this speaks a little bit to the fact that maybe these are some people who've watched some other Christian Jews go through persecution and go through difficult times. He says to these guys, remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. There's an implication here that they passed on. That group is dead. That group of people who went through this initial persecution has left. Remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. So this is a group of people who a few decades later can look back on and have heard stories of. Their parents or their friends or their relatives or their fellow Jewish Christians go through some difficult times. And he's kind of saying, you guys have been down this road, and you shouldn't go back to Judaism, and you need to brace yourself because it's going to get worse. There's more challenges to come. And then over in verse 19 of Hebrews 13, I think there's an implication that he knows them. Whoever this writer is, he spent time with them. He knows them. He's going to reference Timothy a little bit later in the epistle. He says in verse 18, pray for us, for we are sure that we have a clear conscience, desiring to act honorably in all things. And then he says, I urge you the more earnestly to do this in order that I may be restored to you the sooner. So, the audience is a group of people he knows. The audience is a group of people that are clearly Christians. They've been dedicated. They've seen difficult times in the past. We find through the rest of this context, they're slipping back into and getting afraid of their Christian faith and their belief. And he's trying to pull them back into that. And he's going to use this Old Testament theology and these Old Testament references to show them, yeah, Judaism's important. Taught you a lot of significance there. It's all pointing towards Christ. It's all designed to get you to believe what you believe. Thoughts about that, Jeff?
I think it's kind of, I don't know if you guys did this on purpose or if it's just a happy coincidence, but it's kind of interesting that we're taking on this class in light of the quarter that we just had, and most of the people in here, I think. If you weren't teaching, I know you were teaching class, but if you weren't already teaching a class, you had the last month of the class in the auditorium, we were talking about culture. Mm-hmm. And that's a really big element here in this topic as well. It's not just a transition or a change from the old covenant and the old law to a new, better covenant. For these Hebrews, it's also for these Jews, it's a cultural transition as well, which that had to be really, really hard. And it's easy for us to sort of sit here now, 2,000 years later, Monday morning quarterback, and say, it's so clearly better. Why were they having so many challenges and issues? Why couldn't they just see how much better it is? But, you know, it's like one of my favorite 80s bands, to quote them, nothing ever changes unless there's some pain. Right, and this is like really, really painful for them, not just from a religious standpoint, but from a cultural standpoint. Because as we know, there's a lot of culture. That's a big part of Judaism. It was then, it still is today. So they're being like assaulted on multiple fronts as they're trying to make this transition.
Yeah, I was trying to think of how to capture that historical setting, and I thought of that culture clash. Right, you got Jewish culture. Religious and language. That's part of what's interesting about this being called to the Hebrews. Hebrew in the Hebrew means one from like afar, one who's come from a distance. Like in the Old Testament, that's how that word got used. In the New Testament, anytime you see it, it's really just describing the language that people speak. And so the only other time you kind of see that is when Paul says, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, and kind of uses it as a When you use the term Hebrew, you're like kind of hardcore Hebrew. And he says, I'm hardcore of the hardcore. And so I think you've got some hardcore Jewish people in their culture dealing with the culture of Christianity. That's got a culture now, all of a sudden, that clashes with Roman culture and the backdrop of all of this. And I think we have to remember that. I like how you said it's easy to Monday morning quarterback these people and kind of slap them around for, man, how could they be so dense? But when you think about what they're experiencing, and I think even the writer is, he's gentle with them, I think, at times about this. I mean, this is a guy who's trying to kind of, he's kind of trying to drop the hammer on them. He's got to get their attention. He's got to be direct with them.
But you can sense that he cares about these people, and he loves these people, and he understands how difficult this is, and he doesn't soft sell it and soft pedal it. He says, guys, the reason you got to get tough about this is it's going to get worse. This is going to get worse, and so you got to be ready for it when it happens.
Many of these people knew the names of their own ancestors who had died in the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes, standing up for circumcision. You know, if they found circumcised babies, they killed the baby and their mother. So, standing up for these symbols of a relationship with Jehovah, who actually occupied that temple, was in their blood. It was huge in their culture. And now they're being told all these things don't matter. This is a huge change for these people. Yeah. It's going to be difficult for them.
Yeah, it's going to be really challenging. And I think that's why, to Rich's point, the theology of this is important. It's important that he goes back to those roots. We see this in the structure of this. The literary approach of this is, it kind of has these two strands working through it. It's, a lot of people have said, it's less your classic letter, less your classic epistle. Dear group, here's some really important information, some things to put on the refrigerator, some things to inspire you and remember. It goes through a lot of expositional and doctrinal stuff, like we said. It's more sermon. It's more like somebody pleading with some people. It's more like a sermon that's being delivered, because it's punctuated along the way with this exhortation, with these warning pieces that he keeps giving them. So a lot of doctrine, a lot of comparison, a lot of teaching, a lot of metaphorical stuff to give them a reference point, a lot of like showing them how what they're going back to is really supposed to get them towards something else. Sabbath and the high priest, the covenant, the tabernacle, all the things that you guys mentioned. But then it's punctuated by these warnings along the way. It's punctuated by these almost pleading, almost this trying to grab them by the lapels and shake them up a little bit and say, don't you get it? Don't you understand? And then goes back into more doctrine. Let's look at a few of those. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 1 is that first warning that kind of pops up. And so you can see the tone shift. You can see him stepping out of theology at this point, after going into this first chapter, which we'll jump into on Wednesday, and making these Old Testament references. He comes out of it in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 1, and he says, therefore, we have to pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. That's a warning. That's his first, this is why I'm coming to you guys. That's got to be, I'm sure when they got this, they were kind of like, yeah, this is some good theology, this is some good stuff. And when he talks about drifting away, I think they went, uh-oh, he's on to us. He knows kind of where we're at. He knows kind of what we're doing. He knows how we're kind of stepping away from this. Then he goes into more theology in chapter 3, verse 1. He comes back with another warning. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus. Consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses was also faithful in all God's house. In Hebrews chapter 5, verse 11 and 12, is another warning. I think you also see the warnings kind of ratchet up a little bit as he goes through this. They kind of get a little more explicit. They kind of get a little, they cut to the heart a little bit more. This one's a good example of this. About this, we have much to say. And it's hard to explain, since you've become dull of hearing. Oof, that would hurt, right? That would hurt to hear that. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. He just called them immature. That hurts a little bit. And he ratchets these up as he goes, and he makes these along the way a little more significant each time. Hebrews 10. In verse 26, Hebrews 10 and verse 26, for if we go, now this will be good to talk about when we get there. He says, if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries.
from a sermon standpoint, he's coming to the conclusion of the sermon here. There's an invitation coming here, and it's kind of the get back on track, because you're going to lose your salvation. And that last one in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 25. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. Five warnings, each one progressively getting a little more serious and trying to get at their heart a little bit more. So that's kind of the two strands that are woven through this. A lot of the theology, and then a lot of just coming at you with some of the the warning things and the attention getting. Some themes that are in here, you guys have already kind of established this. Christ is better than Judaism. That's definitely in here. Don't forget that I'm going to talk to you about Judaism to set up Christ. Judaism exists so that you would understand Christianity, so that you would understand who Jesus is, so that you would understand salvation through Christ. In many respects, we say it's kind of hard for them. They kind of had to shift out of, some of these people had to shift out of Judaism and then shift into Christianity, but they were had a front row seat to see Judaism kind of leaving, and we got to experience that in order to understand what Christ is about. They're a unique group of people. Don't stop. Don't go back. Faith is a huge theme. Shadows. It's going to talk about shadows and substance, that there are things in the Old Testament that were the mere shadow of what's real, of what's real. You'll see a lot of people, it's not in there, but a lot of people talk about that with the old anti-type and the type. The typeface, right, to print something is actually, that's what you call the type. And then you put a piece of paper on it and it prints and it makes the anti-type. It's the opposite. You have to put an opposite image up there. And he talks about, a lot of people will look at Hebrews through that lens of there's lots of types that were designed to give you something real when it printed. And that real thing that it prints is Jesus Christ. All right. Endurance. We've got endurance athletes. So there's something in this for you. You understand endurance. I'm looking around and I see a lot of endurance athletes. I like the picture of the mom just go day in and day out, right? Understanding endurance from that standpoint of parenting sometimes. It requires endurance. You can't quit. You got to keep moving. You got to keep going. And for the history geeks, that's the Endurance. It's a ship that got stuck in Antarctica in the ice in 1915 and ironically was named Endurance because they had to live down there for like a year and suck it up and survive and get through it. On Wednesday when we come back in, we'll talk briefly about just how to access the class and how to do some of that stuff. But if you can, jump into that first chapter, take a look at the study guide if that helps you, read the first chapter and record some notes, and we'll start to delve into some of this theology on Wednesday night.